I would like to bring this House Special Committee on Fisheries to order. Today is Tuesday, January 31st. Let the record reflect that it is 10 a.m. Today we have present Representative Stutes, Representative Carpenter, and myself, Chair Vance. I'd like to remind the committee and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. We are so happy to have people from the public here and see our fishery faces again. It's been a little while. We have staff assisting us today will be Linda Jensen with House Records and Zachary from the Juneau LAO. Thank you so much. I would like to welcome members to the first Committee on Fisheries, and I have on your desk the welcome letter that just going to highlight some of the things that we cover and on the Fisheries Committee, one of which is just going over the budget subcommittees that we will be members of. We will be reviewing appointments to the Board of Fisheries and looking at the health of the statewide fisheries. I want to cover amendment guidelines. All amendments must be emailed to my office no later than the specified day and time as noticed in the committee, and I will be noticing at the during committee the date and time that any amendments are due on legislation, and all committee bills will be introduced according to the statute. So I just wanted to make that note on the record for members as you have that. Welcome Representative Carpenter, who's a new fishery member. It'll be good times. And we are going to have an overview on the collapse of the Yukon and Kuskokwim fisheries from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And we're trying to get the commissioner online. Let's see if not brief at ease. Our apologies, we're experiencing some technical difficulties, but we do have Commissioner Doug Vincent-Lang online now to be able to give us a presentation on the status of the Arctic, Yukon, and Kuskokwim fisheries. It has been one that most of the state has been looking at, and so I look forward to the report, and members should have the presentation in front of you and then on the screen as well. So, Commissioner, whenever you're ready, please begin your presentation.
Okay, Chairman Vance, I'm representative of the House Fisheries Committee. My name is Doug Vincent-Lang. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. First off, I'm disappointed I'm not on team, so you can see that I actually was able to tie a tie with my shoulder operation. So that was a major accomplishment today. I wanted to just talk to you about a little bit about the AYK region and some of the issues we're having with respect to salmon fisheries in that region and the impact it's having on both people that are dependent upon those resources for commercial fisheries, sport, personal use fisheries, but most importantly for subsistence resources and fishery opportunities that are important to maintaining culture and providing for food security. So I think Joe is running my slide deck down there for me. Can you go to the second slide, please?
And pardon me, Commissioner, I need to reflect for the record. At probably 10:08 a.m., we had Representative McCabe join us and Representative McCormick. Please continue.
So, Joe, are you on slide two? Can you guys see slide two? It's the map of Alaska?
Yes.
Okay. So the AYK region is a fairly large region. It encompasses basically everything north of the Alaska Range. So in purple, you'll see the Kuskokwim region. That's part of the AYK region. The green is the Yukon River drainage. And then you'll see a white area in Canada that also encompasses part of the Yukon River drainage. And that's important because some of those stocks that are in the Yukon River drainage that I'll be discussing today, notably king salmon and fall run chum salmon, have treaty obligations associated with them since those fish spawn both in Alaska and in Canadian waters. They're covered under the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and there's treaty obligations associated with them. Then you have the Norton Sound drainages, which are in orange, And then in kind of a gray color is the Kotzebue Butte Sound Arctic region. Next slide, please. So let's talk a little bit about Yukon River king salmon. So this is a history of drainage-wide total run sizes. As you can see, it's fluctuated anywhere from over time from about 50,000 fish all the way up to 375,000 fish. In essence, in the last 3-4 years, we've seen a decline in king salmon production, which is kind of what we've seen statewide. And as a result of that, we've been slowly having restrictions put in place for, we basically opposed commercial fisheries, and we've also restricted subsistence fisheries, especially in the years 2021 and 2022. The other complicating factor in the Yukon River king salmon fisheries is that they're covered under the Pacific Salmon Treaty, as I said earlier, and we have an obligation under the Pacific Salmon Treaty to pass 42,500 to 55,000 fish into Canada. And as you can see, 4 of the last 5 years, we have failed to meet that Canadian passage obligation at the border. I'll go a little bit more into detail as to why we think that may be happening a little bit later in the presentation. But in essence, with king salmon, we're seeing reduced returns over the last 4 to 5 years. Next slide, please. This is a slide that shows the Yukon River king salmon harvest. In the solid lines, you can see the amounts necessary for subsistence, which is 45,500 to 66,704. And in essence, we have really failed to meet that amount necessary for subsistence. I think we've only met it twice over the last 15 years. And in the last 2 years, we have had very small amounts of subsistence fishing opportunities. And part of the reason is, even though we've had some escapement, we have failed to meet our border passage obligations. And as a result of that, the treaty even takes precedence over subsistence fishing rights. So we have to meet the international treaty obligations. So we take restrictions on our side of the border. Now, some people ask, is that fair? The Canadians have also severely restricted subsistence fishing up and above the border. And so really, subsistence fishing has been affected both downstream of the border and upstream of the border as a result of the poor returns. Next slide, please. This is a graph showing the Yukon River summer chum. Now, this is different than king salmon and fall run chum salmon. These fish spawn entirely in U.S. waters. And as you can see, we've largely been meeting ANS amounts except for the last 3 years. In 2021 was that what was called the chum salmon collapse in the Yukon River. And you can see that basically we had very poor escapement. We were expecting that escapement to be average compared to what it has been in the past, because we put a good parent year escapement in for that run. But for some reason, which we suspect is probably tied to poor marine survivals, we saw a very poor return. Now, in 2022, that's a preliminary estimate, but we are going to be we think that we just barely missed meeting the lower end of the goal. But again, that lower end of the goal came with severe fishing restrictions put in place, so that not even subsistence fishermen are fishing to make, basically meet the lower end of the goal. Next slide, please. This slide shows the harvest again by type in the river. And as you can see, the ANS amounts is 83,500 to 142,000 fish. And we've largely been meeting ANS amounts and providing chums commercial fishery in that river until the last 3 years, which in both 2020, 2021, and 2022, we had severely restricted commercial and subsistence fishing. And in 2021, 22, we didn't really have any subsistence fishing, which means we didn't have any commercial fishing. Next slide, please. This is the Yukon River fall chum salmon run size. And again, you know, we're seeing that this fishery was basically cooking along from 1974 through present. We had a couple bad years from 1998 through 2002, but largely we were providing meeting escapement goals, and we were providing for some harvest opportunities both in Canada and the U.S. on fall chum runs. However, in 2020, just like summer chum, you'll see that again, we failed to meet escapement goals for 2020, 2021, and 2022. But again, 2022 is better than we saw in 2021, which is indicating that these things are starting to rebuild a little bit. Next slide, please. This slide shows the Yukon River fall chum salmon subsistence and personal use harvest. And again, the ANS amounts are in the dark red dark black lines in that graph. We have failed really to meet escapement goals. I mean, amounts necessary for subsistence and for food security reasons in 2020, 2021, and 2022. Again, that was largely because we had to do two things. We had to restrict to meet escapement goals on the U.S. side of the border, and we also had obligations to pass fish into Canada, which resulted in closures on our side of the border to meet those treaty obligations. Next slide. Let's move to the Kuskokwim River now. This is the Kuskokwim River king salmon escapement. Unlike the Yukon, in this case, we're meeting escapement goals into the system. We've met them in all years except for 2010 to 2014, but in the last about 10 years, we've been largely meeting those escapement goals, which is interesting because it's a drainage just south of the Yukon River where we're seeing reduced production rates, but in the Yukon Kuskokwim River, we're at least meeting escapement goals. Next slide, please. This shows the subsistence harvest, again, the current ANS amounts. So although we're meeting escapement goals, we're not meeting ANS ranges. And what you can see is that we're basically providing some harvest opportunity for subsistence users, both in the lower river and the middle upper river. But we're not providing enough to meet the current amounts necessary for subsistence adopted by the Board of Fish. A complicating factor in the Kuskokwim River is jurisdictional issues. In the lower part of the river, in the refuge, the Federal Subsistence Board has claimed jurisdiction over king salmon and chum salmon runs. And there's a court order last year that precluded the state from managing the lower part of the river. And then the state manages the upper part of the river above the refuge. And because of federal management in the lower part of the river, we did not meet some of our king salmon escapement goals in the upper part of the river. And we also had to take some fishery restrictions in the upper part of the river, in the middle part of the river, because some of those fish were taken in the lower part of the river. Next slide. This is Kuskokwim River chum salmon. Shows a very similar picture to what we've seen in the Yukon River. Again, we've seen the average up until 2019 was bouncing around the average line, but 2020, 2021, and 2022 were all, again, way below average in terms of returns. And again, in terms of meeting amounts necessary for subsistence, we weren't achieving those in either the lower river or middle and upper river. Next slide, please. Kuskokwim River coho salmon is showing, again, a kind of a reduced production rate from the average based on the test net fishery in the lower river. From 2018 forward, we've seen kind of a downturn in production, but stability around that downturn. And then for coho salmon subsistence harvest, again, I think we're doing fairly well, at least in trying to provide for or getting close to providing the amounts necessary for subsistence. Next slide, please. Kuskokwim River sockeye salmon. This is kind of a bright spot. I think we're starting to see sockeye salmon perform well across coastal western Alaska. Again, we are providing more fish in terms of sockeye and meeting some of the subsistence needs in that area as a result of some of the increased production of sockeye salmon, especially in the lower Kuskokwim River where we have some lake systems. Next slide. So the summary of coastal western Alaska is that, let me touch base real quick. Norton Sound king salmon and chum salmon are kind of like what we're seeing in the Yukon River. They're below average, and we're seeing, again, restrictions to both commercial and subsistence fishing opportunities to make sure we're meeting the minimum escapement goals in the North Sound and Kuskokwim River areas, Kuskokwim Bay areas. The far north region covered by Upiavik and Kotzebue. In summary, we're seeing king salmon over the last half decade seeing reduced productivity. Chum and coho salmon over the past 3 years have similarly declined. The results of the reductions are we're seeing closed commercial, sport, and personal use fisheries. and we're seeing severely restricted or closed subsistence fisheries. And we understand, based on our travels in the area, that this is having a significant impact on local communities, rural culture and practices, and economies. On the other hand, some of the areas along coastal Western Alaska are seeing increased salmon, sockeye salmon productivity. We're trying to maximize some of the opportunity around sockeye salmon increases by providing some additional opportunities to harvest those fish. However, some of the opportunities for commercially and subsistence are limited due to incidental catch of Chinook, coho, and chum salmon, and our fear that as we use gillnets in the area that we may incidentally harvest Chinook or chum salmon, which we're trying to rebuild those runs. Next slide, please.
Commissioner, before you continue, I'd like to pause for a moment and take any questions from committee members on the slides that you've shown. Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Good morning, Commissioner. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. So through the chair, I'm interested in maybe this will help for help me. I'm ignorant of why the feds have control of the Kings on the Cusco, Lower Cusco.
So through the chair, Representative McCabe, last spring, the United States government sued the state of Alaska and the Commissioner of Fish and Game, who is me, saying that our management was interfering with the management of the Federal Subsistence Board, and was able to convince a federal judge in Alaska to restrain the Department of Fish and Game from issuing emergency orders in the lower part of the river until the case is heard.
Oh, so that's like a temporary injunction kind of thing?
That was an injunction from last year. We suspect the injunction will be put in place this year until the case is heard.
Okay. One other
follow-up. And just real quick, the Kuskokwim River is a navigable waterway, but the Sturgeon case did not settle the subsistence issues. It settled other issues associated with navigability. So this is the test case as to who's got management authority in navigable waterways that are owned by the state, but that are adjacent to or near close abutting federal land.
Follow up
and through the chair. Thanks, Commissioner. I appreciate that. Would the 404, in your opinion, the 404 primacy thing that the state is working on, would that be helpful in resolving this issue one way or the other?
Well, the state, through the chair, Representative McKay, the state firmly believes at the statehood compact, and as a result of the statehood compact, a memorandum from a president that basically delegated fish and game authority to the state, and then that was subsequently reaffirmed during ANILCA. It was subsequently reaffirmed in a variety of federal laws that the authority to manage fish and game resources is the state's, not the federal government's or the Federal Subsistence Board. So we are going to fight to ensure that we maintain that authority. You might ask why we're fighting to maintain authority out in that river system. There are many people that grew up in the Bethel region that, for a variety of socioeconomic, educational, health reasons, no longer live in the Bethel region. They live in Anchorage because of Native hospital, a variety of other things, or because of jobs. And under federal rules, those people can no longer participate in that federally qualified only fishery in the lower Kuskokwim River. We believe that when there's opportunities to provide for subsistence fisheries, they should apply equally to all Alaskans, including those people that have customary and traditional ties that are now displaced into Anchorage, be able to go out and participate in those fisheries. So we think that in this case, the state have an opportunity to manage for those uses out there.
Follow up, Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and I appreciate that, Commissioner, and that's very helpful for other reasons. I'm curious as well. I like all the slides. I don't see anything on any of these slides that talks about the sustainability of the resource. So what's the threshold? Maybe sometime we could have that put in these charts. What is fish and game? What do the biologists feel the threshold is for the resource to be self-sustaining? So what kind of escapement do we need so that in 5, 4, 5, 7 years, however long it is, depending on the fish, we will actually have a run returning? It seems like if you look at all these slides, everything is going down, but every slide is focused on stakeholders and not on the resource. And to me, it takes fish upriver to get fish out of river. I mean, we've said that for years. So maybe we need a bar on there that says this is the very minimum we can tolerate before the resource is completely gone. Maybe that's a comment and not a question, but seeing as how you're a biologist, I figure you're pretty smart on that. So
let me address that. So most of our escaping goals in the state are built around maximum sustained yield. So we want to manage our salmon resources to not only provide for sustainability of the resource, but also sustainability of the fisheries that are dependent upon that resource. So you asked me what's the minimum required to manage for. We're trying to manage that resource over time to not only have sustainable fish in the run, in the return, but also to rebuild the returns to a point where they can provide for sustainable fisheries, with the priority being subsistence and potentially having commercial or personal use fisheries and sport fisheries after we've met our subsistence priority. Because we recognize that a sustainable economy in many of these coastal villages is partially dependent upon food security, which is the subsistence, but also the ability to conduct commercial fisheries provides an income into those communities. So the minimum that we're trying to get back is the minimum end of that escapement goal range is what we're trying to do. But again, that's not just to provide for enough fish to prevent the fish from going extinct. It's really enough to provide for the resource to meet the minimum escapement numbers to ensure that in the future we have fish returning at a surplus number to provide for some uses.
Thanks.
And one last thing I'll add on that question is that I want to make it clear, the state does not believe that these resources are in danger of extinction. These salmon in the Western Alaska streams, including the Yukon and other many drainages, are not providing for uses right now, but the runs are not in danger of going extinct. We're still providing enough to ensure that these stocks are going to rebuild over time.
Thank you, Mike.
But that's going to mean that we're going to have restrictions on fisheries until we get these rebuilt up.
Seeing no further questions from the committee at this time, please continue with your presentation.
Okay. So what are we doing about this? So that's the most common question I'm asked after kind of going through the grim forecast of what we've had the last several years and some of the things that we're moving forward on. The first one is we've distributed food to communities impacted by some of the closures. Let me be perfectly clear. The state does not view distributed salmon as a replacement for being able to go out and harvest them as part of the culture and part of the community and part of food camps and subsistence camps up and down the river. But we thought it was very important at least to get some food in people's freezers to deal with food security issues over the winter. We did that for the last 2 years. We've used COVID funds to kind of get at that money. Those funds are now exhausted, but over the last 2 years, we've worked with non-governmental organizations to especially SeaShare and group out of, that's run by Linda Benkin out of Sitka. And we're convinced now that as we move forward in time, that as government moves out of this, that some of these private groups that are working on this will be able to continue food distributions if the need arises in the near future. The second thing we did is we implemented 2 years ago a marine science program. It became pretty clear to me as commissioner when I came in 4 years ago that we have a pretty good understanding of what's happening in fresh water in many of these drainages and with king salmon across the state, but we really had no idea what's happening in the marine environment. And everything that we were seeing across the state was pointing to changing marine conditions resulting in reduced productivity of some of our salmon stocks. And this is kind of statewide for king salmon and in certain areas kind of for chum salmon in coastal Western Alaska. We were seeing, in general, fish coming back smaller at age. We were seeing fish coming back earlier at age. So that means that what used to come back for a king salmon, what we call the 1-6 fish, now is coming back as a 1-4 and 1-5 fish. seeing overall reduced numbers coming back. Those three data points seem to indicate that the ocean's not a very friendly place to be if you're a chum salmon or a snook salmon. And so we decided that we need to get out the marine environment and try to figure out what's happening out there. So 3 years ago, we started in the marine environment with a program in the Northern Bering Sea to look specifically at Yukon River chum and snook salmon, and trying to figure out how, at least in that first month and a half after they emigrate from the freshwater environment, how that nearshore marine environment is affecting their long-term survival. And that some of the evidence we've collected to date actually does point to the fact that that first month and a half, 2 months out of the sea is having a significant impact on some of the survival rates for at least chum and snook salmon that are moving forward. The other thing the governor's budget is includes money to expand this marine science program into the Southern Bering Sea, which would help answer some of the questions regarding the Kuskokwim River. And we also have this program in place in Southeast Alaska to kind of look at what's happening in Southeast Alaska. We also like to, I think we have money in the budget to, in the governor's request, to actually extend this into the North Gulf of Alaska to start finding out whether there's common linkages between these different areas, different nearshore regions of the state, in terms of how the marine survival is affecting both chum and snook salmon. The third thing we did is that answers some of the questions in the nearshore marine environment, but we also know that after these things spend about 2 or 3 months in the nearshore marine environment, they head out to sea. And we really don't have very good information on what's affecting survival of salmon out in the deep blue ocean. We really don't have a very good idea where these fish are moving to, what their diet composition is, what may be affecting their growth and survival in the ocean. But we realize that as a state of Alaska, we really can't do that work on our own. It requires cooperation of other international entities, as well as, you know, just having ships to go out in that kind of sea. We don't have as a state. So 2 years ago, we decided to get involved in the International Year of the Salmon Marine Survey Program. That's a program that looks basically at what's happening in the deep blue ocean off of in the Gulf of Alaska, from off of Canada and Southeast Alaska, what's happening in the central Gulf of Alaska, basically from Cape Suckling all the way over the Alaska Peninsula. And then a third segment was happening in kind of the western part of the Gulf in the Bering Sea, which is funded by the third segment. We provided funding through North Pacific Research Board, $500,000, and we also provided funding through the Pacific Salmon Treaty Foundations that are Northern Fund, $500,000. So we contributed $1 million over 2 years. And we also staffed some of the ship times. The Canadians did the ship time in the Eastern Gulf. The NOAA did the ship time in the Central Gulf, and Russia did the ship time in the Western Gulf and the Bering Sea. We participated in both of the Eastern and Central Gulf. We did not participate in the Russian surveys for the geopolitical reasons, which I didn't think was right to put our people on Russian ships at the time.
Commissioner?
Go ahead.
Before you continue, I'd like to recognize that Representative Kronk is in the room and has joined us. And also, we have a question from Representative Carpenter.
Good morning, Commissioner. Thanks for being with us. My question is just a little bit more detail on the evidence that is pointing to impacts on survival. What is it that the science program has learned specifically?
Okay. If I can answer that question after I finish the Marine Science, the International Year of the Salmon, I'll answer that right after that. So we participate in the International Year of the Salmon. We had staff out in those ships, and that all that information now from last summer is being analyzed and collected, and in the next year or two, we suspect that we're going to start seeing results from all that data, which shows what the stock composition of the salmon catches were out there and what the relative health conditions and some of the basic oceanography that's associated with those salmon out there. There's a new program, International Year of Salmon is over, but there's a new program being developed by the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission that we'll be looking at potentially joining to continue answering some of these questions in the deep blue sea. Representative Carpenter, the evidence that we have is what we're seeing is that, again, salmon are generally coming back at reduced numbers. They're coming back at reduced size at age. So they're coming back smaller after 4 years than they did previously. And we're also seeing them come back at younger ages. So if you're a salmon, you're swimming out in the ocean, you're not growing as fast. And as a result, you're either dying or deciding that it's such an unfriendly place that you're trying to get back into the ocean at an earlier age than you have historically. And when you get back in, you're smaller. So that seems to indicate to us that something is affecting those fish out there. Now, remember, as the ocean conditions change out there, especially warm, some of the whole food web, bio web out there changes. Some of the phytoplankton populations change, the zooplankton populations change, and then fish, again, are cold-blooded, so their energy demands as it warms goes up a little bit. And then if you're eating less nutritious food, you're just fighting this losing battle out there. So and then in the nearshore marine environment, we're seeing some of the evidence that we're seeing, and we can have Dr. Katie Howard come and give you a presentation on her science program. But what we're seeing is that some of the food conditions when these fish first emigrate out to sea is not as favorable as it was when the water was colder.
Thank you.
Please continue your presentation.
Okay, next slide, Joe. We also heard a lot about bycatch as an issue. So the governor created a bycatch task force, and you either have a copy or we can get you a copy of the recommendations of the bycatch task force. It did do its final report in November 2022, and that was presented to the governor, and the governor is now reviewing that as well as I'm reviewing it. And we are using the recommendations that are within that task force to make actions at both the Board of Fisheries and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, as well as with the department's science program as we move forward. One of the issues was to address the question of bycatch of chum salmon in the Bering Sea. The count, we read this bycatch recommendation, and the council has formed a group right now, a committee to look at developing a problem statement around chum salmon bycatch, and then to develop a list of alternative for analysis that is right now is looking at how you could use time and area closures in the fishery, as well as potentially a bycatch cap as an option of addressing chum salmon bycatch. We also implemented some of them through different kinds of bycatch reduction measures this past 3 years at the council to reduce halibut bycatch and other species bycatch, crab species bycatch. So this is being used, and we'll look forward to using more of it as we implement and design programs moving forward. Other actions we took.
Another question. Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Commissioner, I think it might be important to recognize maybe some of the different sectors that were represented in that bycatch task force.
Yeah, be glad to. So this represented a wide range of individuals across the state of Alaska that were appointed. There were members from the fishing industry. There were members from the AYK region that were involved in this. There were representatives from the crab industry, halibut industry, from in-river sport fishing groups, commercial fishing groups. It had a fairly broad representation of members. And it was the group conducted, I think it was over 45 or 50 meetings over a period of about 9 months. They heard a lot of reports from ADF&G and NOAA scientists over what the state of bycatch is. And they basically came up with a set of recommendations that, again, is solid in my eyes. And most of them reached consensus around many of these different issues. So, yeah, it was a well-represented group of diverse stakeholders that came together to study the issues. And it was very collegial. There were tough discussions, but they actually – again, formed consensus around nearly all the recommendations presented.
Follow-up, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Commissioner, based on that, do you think it's important that this bike catch task force remain in place as opposed to just doing their job and being dissolved, but maybe having a permanent spot as the bycatch task force?
Through the chair, I think we need a little bit of time to kind of go through this report and figure out how we're going to implement it prior to making that decision. So I haven't reached that conclusion as to whether or not we need to keep the task force in place or whether we need to come back and revisit it maybe in 2 years to figure out what it has, because it completed its work. It reviewed the science. It made its recommendations. Now, kind of the recommendations are within the hands of legislature bodies like the North Pacific Management Council, the Alaska Board of Fisheries, and the science groups, including ADF&G and NOAA, to implement it. So I'm not sure whether we would have anything more to report to them over the next year and a half until we implement some of these recommendations and learn some more.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions at this time, please continue.
Okay. So some of the other actions we did is we recognized that chum salmon was a huge issue in the Bering Sea. So this past year we worked with the Bering Sea Trawl Fisheries and asked them to look at ways that they could reduce chum salmon bycatch in their fisheries in a way that would inform the council to take action as part of a regulatory review analysis. So last year they actually did some self-regulation in the fishery, and they had significant reductions in chum salmon bycatch without having incidental chum increases in other species bycatch, notably Chinook salmon. One of the big fears we have with instituting a chum salmon bycatch cap is that right now the fleet is operating under a Chinook salmon bycatch cap that floats with abundance, but they're significantly underneath that cap. In essence, about half, they're about 50% of their cap. So if we make them not catch chum salmon, they could potentially move into waters that have Chinook salmon that and still stay underneath their bycatch cap. So we're asking the industry to look at innovative ways to reduce their bycatch of all species without having these incidental what I call it, the law of unintended consequences of having increases in other species, prohibited species bycatches move forward. And again, that information has gone along. It reduced chum salmon bycatches last year. I got to applaud the trawl industry for the work they did in that area. And it will also inform regulatory actions that the council may be taking in the future. We also formed a committee at the council, as I said, that looked for a list of alternatives for analysis for chum salmon. We also, this last year, heard very loud and clear that the harvest of chum salmon or the incidental harvest of chum salmon in the mixed stock South Peninsula fisheries was a huge issue. 2 years ago, we got surprised by the number of chum salmon harvested in the June portion of the South Peninsula fisheries, which again are mixed stock seine fisheries and gillnet fisheries. Because of confidentiality and a variety of other factors, that the average harvest of chum salmon in that fishery is about a half a million. It got up to about 1.2 million 2 years ago. We worked very closely with the fisheries in that area to have confidentiality waived so we had in-season records of what was being harvested. And we also worked with the fleet on ways that chum salmon could be reduced while we're still maximizing the harvest of sockeye salmon in that fishery that from this chair I sit in, harvesting 4 or 5 million sockeye salmon that are headed to Bristol Bay is a way to at least control some of that harvest before it all hits the Bristol Bay sub-districts. And then we have mixed stock fisheries there in terms of Ushiak kings and other things that are concerned.
Commissioner, we
so, have another question. That was very successful. That program brought our harvest back down to historical levels. If I could just finish real quick. The other thing we did is last year, we collected information to update the genetic analysis of what the chum salmon stock of origin harvest is in that fishery. We know from past lots of study that many of those fish were of Asian origin. So we wanted to have new information to to inform board deliberations at the February meeting coming up on South Penn Fisheries about what the stock composition is in terms of time and area and whether there were hot spots for coastal Western Alaska in that fishery. So that information was collected. We have money in the budget for the next 2 years to validate that over a three-year running average. But that information will be available to the board to inform their decision.
Representative Stutes, you have a question.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Commissioner. So I appreciate the fact that you're working with the trawl industry and in relation to this bycatch. And I know that all the Bering Sea trawl fleet is required to have observer coverage, 24-hour observer coverage. How are you working with the long line or the pot fishermen insofar as their bycatch situation?
Yeah, through the chair, we read that in the bycatch task force, and the council is constantly looking at the issue of bycatch, and because nobody really wants to have bycaught fish in fisheries. The longline industry and the pot fishery are two fisheries that do not have the level of observer coverage that the trawl fishery has, for instance, in the Bering Sea. So we're looking at both electronic monitoring and potentially increased observer coverage in those fisheries as a way to get better estimates of what's happening in the bycatch in those two gear types.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, what Commissioner, is there currently any kind of observer coverage required on the long line or the pot fishermen in the Bering Sea?
In some of the bigger fisheries, there are, but not some of the smaller or medium-sized fisheries. It's a smaller percentage. It's not 100% coverage.
I think just a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. It would seem to me that it's kind of taking a position that maybe they don't have bycatch when, in fact, I think that they're a contributor as well. And I think that we need to take a look at all of our sectors of fisheries. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McKee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, Commissioner, bycatch in a pot fishery is a bit different than bycatch and trawl fishery, is it not?
Yeah, they all have their uniqueness in terms of how fish are caught. For instance, in a longline gear, some halibut could potentially be released, but it depends on how long the halibut are soaked in that longline gear. Some of the rockfish that are caught are probably, that's what in Saywater we have mandatory retention for rockfish that are caught in longline gear, just so we get an idea what the bycatch is. And in pot gear, again, it depends upon the species. You can be a little bit more selective depending upon the type of pot gear used. But again, there is differential rates of bycatch in each of those fisheries in terms of species and in terms of sizes.
Thank you. And through the chair, Commissioner. So I guess what I'm driving at is fish mortality in the different type of bycatch mortality in the different types of fisheries is different, frankly. I mean, the mortality in a trawl fishery of a crab, say, that's pinned up against the net is probably 100% or significant. And bycatch crab caught in a cod pot, say, they get released. Is that a fair statement, I guess?
Yeah, again, a lot of this depends upon how long the gear is soaked for and a wide range of other issues. But with a lot of these pot gear, you can use selective hole openers and gaps to reduce the amount of fish, so you can have escape mechanisms so that some of these smaller crab can get out. But I think we've all seen that, at least in the crab industry, that some of the with the size restrictions we have, there is an issue, so or a unresolved question associated with what's the mortality rate of released crab and crab overboard. We really don't have good information on that right now. That's one of the things I think we're interested in working with industry and getting better estimates for.
Thanks.
Please continue with the presentation.
Okay. Next slide, please. We also are developing spend plans for identified fishery disasters, and there are fishery disasters in coastal Western Alaska that have been identified by the state. submitted to the Secretary of Commerce and for which there's been money associated with them. I got to admit that Alaska's kind of taking the cutting edge on how you incorporate subsistence users into fishery disasters. Fishery disaster laws and statutes at the federal level were largely developed around commercial fisheries, which have very good economic valuation data. It was not nearly as clear as to how you evaluate subsistence, lost subsistence opportunity from both a food security and from a cultural point of view. So I know there's been some frustration in Western Alaska as to how we develop our spend plans, but we've had to take a little bit of time to evaluate the metrics associated with how we're going to incorporate subsistence users into these fisheries disasters moving forward. We've also taken a little bit of time to make sure that as an element of these disaster plans, that we not only just take all the money and distribute it out to fishermen that are impacted, but also spend at least a little bit of money trying to answer some of the fundamental questions as to why these disasters are occurring. So that, you know, kind of like building a home in a floodplain, you don't just keep rebuilding in the same place. You got to kind of answer what's going on with the animals out there that's causing the disasters. And then finally, this last year we worked with Congress to ensure that communities have access to disaster funds. Some of the early disaster programs we had, communities were not eligible to get disaster relief or the criteria associated with how they could spend that money was severely limited. And as most of you are aware, fish taxes that fishermen would pay go into a half of that is shared with communities. And they use it basically as general fund money, not just in support of the fishermen. So we've now worked with Congress to make sure that an element of the spend time can be recovery. Communities are eligible for some of those disaster funds moving forward. And we think that's important because, you know, you can't have community. If the fisherman is being rewarded some portion of the money, and if they had been fishing, they would have been paid fish taxes. We think at least communities should be eligible for some of that to ensure that their losses at the community level are supported.
Commissioner?
We're also working with partners to address our science issues in river. One interesting thing we found out about king salmon in the Yukon River is we've been passing sufficient. We have two sonars on the Yukon River. One is at the at Pilot Station in the lower part of the river, and the second one is at the Canadian border. And at the Pilot River Pilot Station, which is in the lower river, we've been passing sufficient numbers of Canadian origin fish to meet our passage treaty obligations into Canada. But when we get to Pilot Station, when we get to Eagle Sonar, which is at the border, those fish are no longer there. So something is happening to these fish in river. They're either being harvested illegally, which we don't think is the cause, or they're dying because of heat stress or something else. But several years ago, we got alerted that ichthyophonus, which is a fungal disease in fish, is more prevalent than, has become more prevalent than in previous years. And ichthyophonus is a fungal disease that these fish catch when they're living in the marine environment, but they're healthy enough in the marine environment that doesn't really have a debilitating effect on them until they enter into fresh water and their immune system starts going down as they start migrating upstream and stop eating. So we put a study together this last year to start looking at the rates and severity of ichthyophonus at the Pilot Station, at the Rapids, and then at the Eagle River Sonar. And we actually did find out that ichthyophonus is more prevalent than we thought it was, and in many cases more severe. So that study is going to continue for the next several years to try to get a handle on how that is a driving factor on how many fish we're trying to pass to meet our treaty obligations into Canada.
Commissioner?
We also are initiating a study this year on radio telemetry for king salmon. We're going to tag fish at the pilot sonar station with radio tags, and then we're going to try to figure out how they're moving through the river all the way up to the Eagle River sonar, hopefully to better inform and tell us, you know, where these fish are moving, where they're holding, and also to inform the possible placement of a mid-river sonar site somewhere in the Yukon River. We got to have sonar placement is a critical element when you put a new sonar in, and you can spend a lot of money and put it in the wrong place if you're trying to count one fish species versus another fish species. So we're collecting that radio telemetry information to better inform where we would put a mid-river sonar. Then we're also beginning a study this year on fall chum near the border to determine in-river factors affecting survival. So we're looking at a chum salmon run that's in Alaska waters and one in Canada waters, and doing kind of a compare and contrast to try to figure out what's happening with fall chum salmon.
Commissioner, Representative Carpenter has a question.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair. And this might be a question for the budget subcommittee process, but I'm curious what percentage breakdown is the research portion of this spend plan?
Through the Chair, we've been successful as a department in getting additional federal money through the Pacific Salmon Treaty to add a lot of these studies into our budget. So there hasn't been a lot of general fund. Last year, there were several pieces added into the budget, that like the in-river sonar piece that's being funded by that went to one of the groups up in Central Alaska. So we're working with them on the Yukon River as to where to put that sonar. So there is money going in to answer these questions, and there's a lot of interest in by the federal government as well as stakeholders to partner to try to answer these questions.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair. So my question is, on the spend plans, what percentage of the money is being planned for remaining in the administration for research, and what portion is being planned to go out to individual fishers for the disaster relief?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. Through the Chair, the vast majority of the money is going out to non-research. I think we're looking at someplace on the order of 15 to 20% in some cases, depending upon what we're hearing back is in terms of public comment on the draft spend plans. It may be as high as 25% for CRAP, but almost all of it is less than a quarter of the amount of money that's been secured. Most of it's going out to affected communities and fishermen.
Thank you.
Commissioner, if I asked you this question previously, but I think it's pertinent for the public, can you speak just briefly about the spend plan and the positive changes for Alaska? I specifically asked on how the distribution was going to occur for communities and subsistence users, because our commercial fishermen have kind of gotten the short end of the stick through the PAC states, and you had a positive update that I think is pertinent to share.
So I know there's been a lot of frustration over Pacific states being the designated federal entity to develop spend plans. So I don't know how many of you on the committee may or may not know about disasters, but let me just kind of run through the process of how a disaster evolves through the process. So the first thing is an affected user group petitions the governor to declare a disaster for their fishery. The state then conducts a review of that information in context of the criteria associated with with two federal laws, Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Act and the Interjurisdictional Fisheries Act. And we make an assessment as to whether or not that fishery requested disaster meets those criteria. The governor then sends that information to the Secretary of Commerce, who then does their review as to whether or not the state's review is adequate or inadequate to make a fishery disaster. Now, some of that takes a little bit of time to go through because we have to have information to compare that fishery to economic impacts from the last 3 years. So we have to kind of wait till the fishery's over then to actually submit it, especially in those cases where a fishery was partially conducted. Then after that, the Secretary of Commerce will make a determination that, yes, in fact, this is a fishery disaster, but that doesn't mean there's money secured for it. They then go to Congress to secure money for the fishery disasters And at that point in time, Congress then makes an allocation of money to commerce to fund a disaster. Often a package of funding is given, then the Secretary of Commerce makes a allocation of either the complete amount for that disaster or more often a smaller amount that based on the allocation that Congress gave them for that disaster. That then triggers under the law a requirement for the state then to develop a spend plan as to how that money is allocated between affected fishermen, communities, research, and other components. Now, one thing we could do to speed that up is to just develop that spend plan, but as a Commissioner of Fish and Game, I thought it was critically important for us to take a shot at it, but send that out for public review. I thought it was critical to take a little bit of opportunity to get the public involved in how that money should be spent. So part of the problem is, although it takes a little bit more time, I think the overall development of a spend plan is improved by having public participation in that. Once that spend plan is approved, we submit it to Secretary of Commerce, who then gives that to the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission as the federal designee to implement that spend plan. And I know there's been a lot of frustration over the last years in how long it's taken Pacific States to get that money out. We've taken steps at Pacific States to speed that process up. There's a new executive director hired for Pacific States that understands the need to make this a priority within that organization. And also, we've also encouraged them to potentially use a little bit more of their administrative fees and get some additional staff time hired to get this money out the door quicker. And I'm assured that these changes we've had at that group is going to make a difference and potentially get these money out the door quicker. The bottom line is spend plans are not, I mean, disasters are not quick. It's not kind of like State Farm where you just file a claim and get insurance. Under the legal system and the statutory framework, they take time to work their way through and develop. But we're doing our best to streamline that as fast as possible without jeopardizing how the public's involved in it.
Commissioner, have you had a positive response from getting the community involvement with these spend plans?
Yes, we have, because, you know, we involve them kind of in the development of them, but we often hear from people that we may not have heard in that process. And yeah, I think almost everybody appreciates the opportunity to weigh in. We understand that we try to provide a balance over, you know, oftentimes these spend plans are put out during fishing season, but we try to find the right balance and expediency towards getting money out the door, but public having, you know, at least 2 to 3 weeks for people to comment on.
Well, I think that's greatly appreciated. One of the, and I thank you for encouraging PAC states to take a better direction and more proactive approach. It's not just the delivery of the funds, but it's also the customer service involved in helping our fishermen and those recipients be able to get through that process. And that's been a very frustrating problem among the fleet. And so thank you for that. I'm hopeful that we can see some positive changes in that. And before I have you continue, I'm going to ask if there's any further questions from the committee members. Okay, please continue.
Okay, next slide, please. Some of the other things we're doing to address the coastal Western Alaskan chum salmon reduced production is work with the Board of Fish in Canada on options to provide a limited number of salmon for culture camps. I just attended the AYK board meeting, listened very carefully to the public testimony. It was very heartfelt and very impactful. And one of the things that people asked us to consider was, is there a way short of providing for, at least for summer, which is under complete jurisdiction, is there some way that we could provide some limited number of fish so that people could operate culture camps up and down the river? And even though it's not providing for, you know, a full subsistence fishery, it's keeping people's fingers on salmon as we move forward. So we didn't get that quite there at the Board of Fish meeting, but we now have people talking about how we could use the department's educational permit system to provide some limited number of fish, you know, that can keep people engaged in fishing and try to keep the culture alive while we build these stocks so that we can get back to vibrant subsistence fishing opportunities. We're also in Canada, looking at opportunities for Chinook salmon. It's a little bit more complex because, you know, if there were any fish we take in the lower river are fish that potentially impact our ability to meet our passage obligations. But I can tell you at least some of those initial conversations have been not just a shut door, but have been at least an interest in looking at ways that we can keep culture alive on both sides of the border while we rebuild king salmon runs. We're also looking at hatcheries. I know there's a lot of interest in building a hatchery to help rehabilitate these runs so that we can get back quicker rather than later. As Commissioner of Fish and Game, I have a little worry about hatcheries that are in river that for rehabilitation purposes, and especially after looking at some of the experiences that happened in Puget Sound and other areas. It's not that it can't be done. It just needs to be done in a manner that is very thoughtful and so that we don't have the law of unintended consequences bite us. And by saying that, it's location of a hatchery and the operations of the hatchery are critical. So there's a lot of, I went to the Yukon River Joint Panel meeting and we talked about hatcheries, and there's not uniform support for the construction of a chum salmon or king salmon hatchery in that river system right now. And a lot of it has to do with who would potentially benefit, who wouldn't benefit from that hatchery. For king salmon, it's pretty clear to me that the level of support for a king salmon hatchery improves the further upriver you put that king salmon hatchery. If you put it in the Middle River, someplace in the Tanana, and there's no upriver benefit, you kind of lose the support of Canada, and you lose the support of all the upriver users in the Yukon. But if you put it potentially in Canada, then you potentially have benefits all the way up the river, and you could basically mark all the fish and have a mark select fishery. So we've actually initiated discussion with Canada about the prospects of increasing the hatchery production in Canada to rehabilitate these runs, especially the Canadian origin runs, and provide some opportunities for subsistence harvest up and down the river. And then the last thing is there's a lot of interest in incubation boxes in the Cuffs and Permanent Northern Sound areas. I want to make it clear that the department's not opposed to permitting those. We are fully supportive of permitting those in-river incubation boxes. So if you hear from them as legislators, we encourage them to submit applications to us, and we'll permit them. So then finally, we're working with the federal government on leveraging infrastructure and build back dollars to fund some of this research moving forward. The federal government has really been holding on to a lot of money in the infrastructure and build back better dollars until they kind of figured out how they wanted to spend it. And just recently, those doors have started opening. We've been talked to by at least the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA now is there's some opportunities for conducting joint research in these areas. And again, we're very open to working with other partners to leverage money, both in federal and state dollars, to try to answer these questions. And then finally, I can tell you that what's happening in the Kuskokwim River with the U.S. government's lawsuit is really, you know, hindering a lot of that cooperation in the Kuskokwim River. We have a good relationship with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Yukon, but we have in the Kuskokwim River, it's a completely different relationship in terms of how we jointly manage that river to ensure that everybody's subsistence uses, both downriver and upriver, are being met. So that's pretty much all I have right now. I want to apologize for not being down there. I tried to catch a flight down there, but I have a doctor's appointment to get some stitches out tomorrow, and I just couldn't get there. But I would like to come down and actually talk to you guys in person if there's another opportunity in the future.
We appreciate your availability. And I do have a couple more questions about the in-river incubation boxes. Would this be under the educational permit system? Can you just kind of expound on that a little bit more, the authority that Fish and Game has to be able to issue these permits?
That would be through our hatchery permitting program. It wouldn't be through the educational permit. And And these have been tried. You know, they've been tried up in the North Sound area. And I know one individual was asking for a permit, and we said, yeah, we'll offer you a permit. But best I could tell, although there's interest in it, and ever since we said we would permit it, and we haven't yet to receive an application. So we're interested in finding out whether there's been advances in technology to try to make this work. But not worth that effort. It just didn't work as envisioned.
So is there a difference between a full-scale hatchery and these incubation boxes that are being proposed?
Yeah, the in-river incubation boxes basically take egg stock from the area and put them in incubator boxes along the stream in a location where you have upwelling. And the theory is that if you have really cold weather conditions in the in-river area, you can increase survival by having these incubator boxes. Again, a lot of the evidence is pointing to the fact that you're having poor marine survival, more that's driving this more than freshwater survival conditions. But again, this is we're open to looking at anything and everything to do this. But from our point of view, a lot of this is related to the ocean, not to freshwater survival. In most cases where you're trying to deal with a hatchery, you're trying to increase the freshwater survival phase of these fish.
Thank you for that. Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none at this time, thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation and for the work on this. And we pray that your post-op, stitch removal is going to go well and that you can have full use of your shoulder, especially, as the fishing season is going to begin in a few months for you. You want to be able to have full access to that. I did want to let the committee know that I intend to have the bycatch task force, some members come and make a presentation on their work so that we can have a better understanding of the work that they did, where we can go as a state from here. And one of the things that I'm continuing to clarify is that the issue of bycatch is more in the federal jurisdiction under the MPFMC. But it begs the question, how is that impacting in-river use in our state fisheries where we do hold jurisdiction in this committee? And I think that's a very relevant question that we need to take a deeper dive. So I intend to do that. It's just a matter of scheduling. They're very busy people with the meetings coming up. But we will have that in the near future. And then as budget subcommittees take off it soon, we will be able to dig into more of the research and funding for that and how that's going to be accounted for. But that concludes our business for today. Our next committee hearing will be on Thursday, February 2nd, and the committee will be hearing HB 19, Registration of Boats Exemption, in its first hearing. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that it is 11:14 a.m.